Bound.
Trying to say that.
Hello and welcome to Susegaad Stories from Goa. I'm your host, Clive D'Souza. I'm a three-time published author, media professional, and a Goan who loves everything about Goa. My latest book is called Susegaad, The Goan Art of Contentment. In my podcast, I chat with some famous and some of my favorite Goans, and together we explore Goa beyond its beaches. From Feni to Fado, Kasa to Cashews, come discover Goa like you've never done before. In today's episode, we're really going to go beyond the beaches and into the villages, and we're going to travel back in time. If you want to know why Goa is so peaceful and Susegaad, this episode will give you that answer. We'll go back hundreds of years to look at Goa's rich history and culture, all thanks to a madman who chose to preserve and restore ancient artifacts and items from the past. Victor Hugo Gomes has built a collection of more than 4,000 ancient objects, many of them 300 years old. A man who went from painter to preserver. He's the founder of three museums with visitors like Robert De Niro and Orhan Pamuk. While he sometimes calls his museums old age homes, they are actually living symbols of Goa's multicultural past. They make ancient stories come alive and maybe even show us how to live in the present. Today we will go on that journey with Victor Hugo Gomes. Welcome, Victor, to the Susegaad Stories podcast.
Thank you, Clyde. And I'm happy to give you whatever information, whatever you want to know about my journey.
I'm really, really excited to talk to you. And more than my listeners, I think I'm excited to listen to all your stories and your entire journey. So before we start, I want to give our listeners a sense of where you are, the visual surroundings, because Goa is all about this rich, lovely visual feast for our eyes, right? So can you tell me where in beautiful Goa are you talking to me from?
I'm in Binawalan, the place where I was born and brought up. Basically, me and my passion about collecting started in Binawalan in my home.
Yeah, Binawalan is a place in South Goa, right, for our listeners. And it's known for the Taj Hotel. And there are two lovely beaches over there, slightly quieter, much more green than North Goa, right? And I think a lot of listeners might have been to St. Martin's, which is a bit of a distance from Binawalan at Betel Batim. But yeah, basically, this is Binawalan where you are at, right now.
Also, you know, this story, the mythological story where Lord Parshuram threw an arrow from the Western Ghats and the sea receded. They say that the arrow landed in Binawalan, and that's how Binawalan got its name, Ban Ale. Okay, the arrow has come. The arrow where it fell is very close to Goa Chitra, my museums, the lake where they say that the arrow had fallen. And Binawalan is also the birthplace of the only saint of Goan origin, Saint Jose Vaz. He was born in my neighborhood.
Yes, amazing. I mean, it's really divine. I mean, you know, the fact that Goa Chitra is there, which honestly has like this divine backdrop and history to it. Brilliant. So when I was writing my book, Susegaad, which is all about how we can find contentment and how Goa has helped us that, I obviously had to deal with the concept of Goan culture, right? And Goa has so many influences from Hinduism to Islamic to Buddhist, of course, to Portuguese. So when I came across the concept of Goa Chitra and your mission, it seems to me that it's not just a place where you just look at the walls. You know, when you go to other museums, you just stare at a wall. But at Goa Chitra, you are kind of, you know, brought into the whole story of Goa and the story of the people who worked so hard to live in a certain way, right? So I want to know, what was that first artifact in your own house that you may have spotted and may have made you realize, okay, wow, I need to really preserve this for myself and for future generations? What was that first artifact that you came across in your very own house?
Okay, Clyde, my mother was a collector, but not collector of artifacts. In a house, we have a cupboard. I never understood that cupboard before. In a house, we have a cupboard with six shelves. We are six children. Okay. On the first shelf, my mother had saved the toys of my eldest brother. We have a difference of 3 years between each one of us, each siblings, and 7 years with my youngest. So on the first shelf was my brother's toys, which were all wooden toys. On the next shelf was my elder sister, partly wooden, partly metal. On the third shelf were metal toys. On the fourth shelf, again, were metal toys. Okay, that was me. Fifth was the sister after me. After that was my younger sister. Okay, her toys. So in 15 years' time, I could see a jump from wooden toys to Barbie dolls. We had changed that fast. So it was basically that.
Wow. Okay,
collecting. What my mother had collected was something that really attracted me. Another thing, my mother used to love collecting crockery from across the world, you know. And every time, whenever someone asked her what gift she wants, okay, she would say crockery. She never allowed that crockery to be used because she believed that if one piece of that set breaks, then the full set is useless. So I understood the importance of sets. Even when I buy furniture, if it's a set, yes, I would buy for the museum. If it is statues, if it's a set, I would buy. I was also fascinated with machines. You know, every old Goan home has got attics, you know, where they used to keep all the old things. We were never allowed as children to go to the attic, nor to the storeroom, nor to the kitchen. So whenever they used to sleep, what you call susega, the afternoon nap, whenever my parents slept, that was the time I used to explore, go on the attic. The first things that I collected were machines, you know, the valve amplifiers, valve radios, you know, agricultural tools. Okay, that was my collection. Then after that, I started going to my relative's house. During vacations, I used to go to my godmother's house in Kurturi. After everyone slept, I used to go around exploring their house. I remember once I found a razor, which was a brass razor, and I had seen my parents. I was about 4 or 5 years old. So I thought, okay, hey, razor, this is how I saw my dad using it. And I just used it once, okay, on my head, side of my head. Okay, and I went, continued with my exploration. And next minute, I hear my grandmother screaming. Okay, I had shaved myself on one side. Okay, so using that tool, you know. Yeah, so a lot of these things have happened. Okay, but very important, Clyde, what you should understand, why am I, where am I today? Recently, about a couple of weeks ago, I was called to my ancestral house, okay, that they were restoring it and that they found some trunks and some pots, you know, clay pots. So when I went there, I found this huge tizals, you know, what you in South Goa we call kulne, in North Goa you call it tizal. Huge clay pots, which I had never ever seen in my life, you know, about 3 feet wide. That collection, I think, is one of my best pieces, which I've got from my ancestral home. It speaks about how these tizals were brought out during celebrations, you know, be it the village feast or a wedding or something occasion that was happening in the house. They would be cooking huge quantities in those huge clay tizals. I don't think anyone in Goa has got that. I'm really proud to have that.
Can you just describe the tizals for our audience? Because many of them may not know. I mean, I know what it is, but can you just tell our audience, just describe a little bit about the tizal for us?
Tizal is a clay pot, which is flat, which is more or less flat and wide at the center. Very wide, and it has got a very wide mouth. So that was used to cook huge quantities of whether it was shakuti or sorpatel or vindal. All that was cooked. The big quantities were cooked in tizals. The smaller ones were known as kuine. So it's basically a wide mouth, wide body, and a round base, which was used for cooking curries.
Great. So I remember when I was watching your TED Talk and even your documentary, I came across how the logo itself of Goa Chitra came about and how you first restored what is called the ghano, I think.
Correct.
Which is basically the oil mill, a traditional oil mill, right? So that's a very amazing story because, I mean, it's some very close to me because it's very creative and, you know, you've incorporated it into your logo. So can you just share that story of the ghano, what it is, where did you find it and how that led to the beginnings of Goa Chitra, please?
Yes. Goa Chitra would have never, ever happened. I would have never, ever set up the museum. This ghano, you know, my grandmother had told me about this ghano, oil grinder, you know, that everyone would go with their cobrain, that is dry coconut, okay, to the miller. For 14 years, I was trying to locate a ghano. I've been across Goa, village to village, wherever there was a Ganekar, the miller. Then finally, I was told that there was a Gano in Agonda. Okay, so a friend of mine and me, we drove all the way to Agonda. And it was a very funny, very eerie scene. When we reached there, we saw hundreds of workers in that property, and you know, doing retaining walls, some sort. It was a beautiful beachfront property. Okay, so I asked them, who's this Ganekar? Okay, they pointed at an old man who was standing there. And in the corner of the property, there was this huge bonfire. You know, something was being burnt. I thought it was dry leaves. They were cleaning the property. So I went, met the Ganekar, and I asked him, I said, oh, Tung Ganekar, are you the Ganekar? He said, yes. I said, do you have the Gano? He pointed at the fire. That Gano was burnt in front of me. Okay, so by the time I reached the place of the fire, it was totally burnt. And apparently that property was bought by an ex-chief minister, okay, promising that old man that he would give promotion to his son. Okay, that's why I wrote about it. I wrote about this full story. Okay, then as I was coming back, someone asked for a lift. He was going to some place in Kanakona on my way. Okay, and he asked me, you know, what are you doing? Why did you come here? Where did you go? I said, no, I had gone to the Ganekar. I'm looking for a Gano. He said, there was another Gano, he said. Let's go right now. It's on our way. So he stopped halfway on the road. He said, that's his son. The tailor is his son. I went and met the son. He said, my father had discarded the Gano. It is thrown out somewhere. Okay, but it is there, I think, he said. Okay, but you can't come now because his father had a heart attack and he was in hospital. After about 3 months or 4 months, I called him up. I called him up. I said, can I come and see the Gano? He said, yes, we found it. It is thrown out just outside our store. Okay, come and talk to my father. So when I went there, that Gano was totally eaten up, totally eaten up. I asked for it. Okay, that old man was so happy that something that he had discarded is being taken by someone, okay, to keep. Yeah, I brought it home. I had to grout it in the ground. It's a huge piece. I had to grout it in the ground to restore it. So in one of my field patches, I grouted it. And I was repairing it. It took me almost about 2 years to restore that. Yeah, I used to work on it, give up, work on it, give up. So during monsoons, I had to build a shed over it. Okay, so that it does not get spoiled with the water. So that shed became the museum. I just extended the four sides of the shed and I started displaying my other collection. That's how Goa Chitra was born. I was not supposed to set up a museum. It happened because of this Gano.
That is truly amazing. It just shows how something that, you know, that you start from one small thing, one little obsession, which leads to something now as glorious as three museums where Hollywood celebrities come and visit it. It's truly amazing and shows the power of just doing something small that, you know, you can kind of focus on. And now it brings me to something which is very personal to me as well. I lost my godmother like last year, actually, and she has actually gifted me an old typewriter. I think it must be about 100, 150 years old. So that's the only thing that I have, which takes me to my own past, you know. So I think it's amazing what you've done and how you've kind of, you know, brought all of these little things. Now, the other thing that I saw is that your you know, the kind of different other artifacts that you've kind of got is like which you spoke about. There is apparently the yoke that our ancient Goan ancestors used, which is, you know, used for grazing of cows, the yoke. Can you just share with our audiences how that is so sustainable and, you know, just very short, quickly you can take us through that artifact that you found, the yoke?
Yes. You know, our ancestors were self-sufficient. Okay, they were wise. Whatever they learned was through experiments and understanding material. Okay, we say that the banyan tree is a religious tree we are not supposed to cut, right? The yoke is a tool or agricultural tool that touches the body of a draft animal. All the other tools, be it a plow, be it a leveler, be it a harrow, everything is connected to it, including a bullock cart, is tied to the yoke. So anyone would say that yoke, being such a precious tool, would be of teak wood or something, good quality wood, right? Our ancestors never used teak wood, even though teak wood was easily available. Okay, they used the wood of the very tree which we consider as a religious tree, the banyan tree wood. Why did they use banyan tree wood? Why not teak wood? First and foremost, the character of teak. Teak is hitty. It would give blisters on necks of animals. Whereas banyan tree wood is light, soft, and cool. It wouldn't harm the animal. Same with the harnesses that were made. We being a part of the Western coast, anyone would say that those ropes were made of coir. No, they were never made of coir. Okay, all the harnesses were made from bark of a tree called kumboi or kiwan. Again, very cooling. Even the women those days, the string that they would use to tie their ghagra or undergarments was always from kiwan, thread made out of kiwan, you know, rope made out of kiwan. Okay, that conscious we were, our ancestors, that wise, because even cotton cuts into your body, whereas kiwan does not cut into your body. You wouldn't get those, you know, string marks that we get on our waist.
Hmm.
That was how well informed our ancestors were about every material.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly shows, right? I mean, this is the reason when a lot of people who are listening to this podcast, they need to understand that it is this 300, 400, maybe 1,000-year-old wisdom, that agrarian lifestyle, which this comunidad lifestyle of Goa that has seeped into Goans. And that's what kind of makes it such a wonderful, almost heavenly place. And that's what they need to learn and understand and maybe fall in love with, right?
The Goan yoke, the design of the yoke is, again, a very slick design, keeping in mind the comfort of the draft animals that we used to use those days. We basically had the Surat breed, okay, and we had the water buffalo. These were the two animals that were used for draft operations or for agricultural operations. Whereas if you look at other parts of India, the yoke is very heavy. Even when I went to Europe, the yokes that I've seen, they're heavy. They literally kept the head, the neck of the cattle, okay, in one place, you know. Whereas our yoke is beautiful, okay, and very flexible for the animal to move, you know. It was such a wonderful thing, you know, like I even have the whip. Okay, no whips were ever used on animals. They used to just rub that whip along the body of the animal so that the animals do not get hurt. You know, that wonderful ancestry was here.
Absolutely amazing. And really, it looks like Lord Parshuram's arrow did fall, and that's what made Goa so divine. And now the great thing is that some of this wisdom is right there in Goa Chitra. And from what I understand, that people can actually use some of these things. You've allowed them to kind of, you have a little farm, I think, at Goa Chitra, and people can actually use some of these artifacts. Is that right? Can you tell us about
this
a bit?
Yes. What we do is 16th of October every year, which is World Food Day, and it also happens to be the birthday of my mother, late mother. So I do my annual harvest every year on 16th of October, where we bring part of the tools out. My threshing machine. I have a nice threshing machine, you know, where kids can actually do the threshing. Okay, then we use the harvesting tools, but everyone has to get into the field, get into that muck, get themselves dirty. Okay, and after them, when I to animate them, I have a nice brass band that plays music right through. I feed them kanji with pickle and salt fish. After that, I give them a nice meal, you know, after they have a shower. You know, we have almost about 300 people who come for that harvest of mine, where these tools are used. Also, on 19th of December, okay, we do the Christmas traditions revival, where I bring some of the sweet making tools, utensils out. Okay, and they are actually used to make sweets. So the adults, we teach them how to make sweets. And the children, we teach them how to make lanterns, how to make crepes using natural material. It's all about that. It's all about self-sufficiency. My museums, they do not have a religion. My museums do not have caste.
Yeah, amazing. Because, I mean, like you mentioned, 19th of December, as people should also know, it's also Goa Liberation Day, which is a holiday in Goa. And that's the perfect time to bring communities together, Goans together. And this whole sweet making thing, again, takes me back to my grandmother as well. And I also was brought up by my grandmother, incidentally. And she used to make dodol on this huge pot. And the dodol was made for the entire village, I think. It seemed like it, at least at that time.
Yeah.
So that's a great thing. And this happens, you're saying, every 19th of December that you do that, right? And anybody
yes.
can participate, is it?
Normally, people book it. People who know, they call us up, yeah. Yeah, also on 1st of May, which is Labor Day, okay, we do Purumanth Festival, okay, or Festival of Provisions. Because in Goa, there was a practice where just before the monsoons, the entire family would get together and make pickles and jams and para, dry kokum or tamarind, okay, make provisions for the monsoons. So we also do that. We teach people how to make pickles and jams on 1st of May every year.
Yeah, I hope, you know, some of our listeners who are listening to all of this pick up on all of this thing, because Purimanth is such a very important tradition of Goa. It's basically making the provisions before the monsoons. So all your dried parra, which is the fish, dried bombil, maybe pickles, mango seeds. I remember in Kolwale, I was given the job of making sure that when the mangoes were kept to dry, the crows would not come and pick them up. That was my job. Yeah. So I remember that, how I used to participate in the Purimanth. So it's amazing that you're doing all of this. And I hope that, you know, everybody who's going to Goa, when they go to Goa, they don't just go to the usual beaches. Of course, they can enjoy that, but to try and participate in some of these things, because you're keeping these ancient traditions alive. And that, I think, is amazing. And now coming to the next part of our conversation, which is a little linked to the food. You've started your next two ventures, which you, I think, are about to start, or one you've already started. One is the fishing museum, right? That you mentioned to me, and Goa Cozinha, which is the food museum. So this is amazing, because obviously I love Goan food, and who doesn't? You've got to be crazy if you don't. So just tell our listeners about the fishing museum and Goa Cozinha, a little bit about that.
The new museums that I'm thinking of, or the one that I've already started, the fishing museum, which is known as the Karvi Abode. The idea is to educate people about museums. Number one, I'm not talking about guests and visitors. I'm talking about our own Goans. So the reason why I set up Karvi Abode, or the fishing museum, away from Goa Chitra and also in a fishing village, it's set up in Betul, which is a traditional fishing village. The idea is to take the museum to the people to whom those objects belong, so that they have that sense of pride that these things that we used to use are displayed in a museum, and there are hundreds of people who come and see it. That is one. Secondly, not to discard these old things, not to run away from these old things, but take that sense of pride. So my fishing museum is basically my collection of boats that were used in the past, my collection of fishing-related stuff like nets, traps, different things, and also my collection of seashells, corals, and fossils from across the world. 9,000 odd seashells, corals, and fossils, highly documented. Who was the diver, which year, which waters, what depth.
Amazing.
So the culinary museum that I'm working on, we have a very, very rich culinary tradition. We have the Hindu tradition. We have the Catholic tradition. We have a fusion that has happened. Okay. Also, the trees that we used to have in our backyards, be it a tamarind tree, or be it a bimbli tree, or be it your ambares, you know, on my farm, I have the sections, you know, different types of trees that were used in food. Okay, the idea is to bring that pride. You know, Goan food, we can be proud about Goan food for one reason. Our food is colorful, unlike rest of India, where the base gravy is the same for different dishes. Whereas here in Goa, it's colorful. A kafrial is greenish in color. Kabidel is blackish in color because they use blood. A sorpatel is a different color. A prawn curry is a different color. A shakuti is a different color. You know, everything is about colors. Okay, different types of ingredients. It is not only about food. You know, when we look at food, we look at food as to fill your stomach. Food was never that. Food was supposed to be for your well-being. Like, there was different type of dishes using certain type of ingredients that was cooked when the woman was pregnant. There was certain type of dishes that were cooked with certain ingredients when she delivered the baby. There were certain type of dishes using certain ingredients, okay, that was cooked, you know, when the child stepped into the world of adulthood. Okay, there was a purpose behind food. I remember growing up, you know, when we were young, okay, in the month of March, April, beginning of April, we were given a juice, very, very bitter juice. My mother used to boil those leaves of a certain plant, you know, which very, very bitter. It's wild neem, actually, which is in Konkani, we call it kodulimbu.
Yeah.
In the morning, they used to give us a small kopin, a small shot of that. We had to drink that bitter. I used to hate it. Okay, but drink it. Compulsorily, we had to drink it. Why? The reason was that in the month of April, May, we would be consuming a lot of jackfruits and mangoes, which are hitty and sweet. Today, that same kodu limbu, okay, is given to patients who suffer from diabetics. Can you imagine? Our ancestors were so far ahead that they gave us this in order to avoid that heat or that sweetness destroying us. Okay, that is exactly what we want to introduce. So the Culinary Museum will have more than 10,000 objects that were used in kitchens. Number two, it will have an open kitchen where people will be able to see how food was cooked using those utensils on wood fire, and they'll get to taste it. The focus of food will be the forgotten food of Goa.
Wow, that's amazing. And you have brought up that memory of Kodok, which even now I remember, which my granny as well used to give me. And I remember that she used to also do another thing, which is whenever we had colds, she used to light up a bit of feni with a bit of sugar and give me that as well on a spoon.
In order to remove the alcohol content. Yeah.
So I think we are all looking forward to Goa Cuisinia as well as your fishing museum. So now the other thing that you have mentioned to me is that you also told me that, you know, all the artifacts in your museum are like children of yours, right? And so in some ways, it's also like an old age home because you are only preserving them for a certain amount of time. And after that time, they'll probably, you know, not be there to last. So what you're doing is you're making miniature models as well, right, of these. So can you just name maybe three miniature models and can people buy these, you know?
Okay, I'll tell you why I said it's an old age home. Every object at Goa Chitra is made of natural material. Anything natural has to die someday. Okay, so as an old age home, It's not because they're old objects. It's like, you know, the way you would take care of adults in an old age home, you prolong their death. That's exactly what we do. I treat every object as my child. Every day, twice a day, I take a round through the museum checking each and every object. Whether there's a fungal attack, whether there's an insect attack, is done on a daily basis. They are my children. I don't have children of my own. Okay, so these museums and the entire collection, we've got over 40,000 objects in our collection. Now, the reason behind the miniatures, okay, is these objects, I know they would die. Till I am there, I prolong that death. We need to use these people who made these tools. Some of them are still living. Okay, we use their wisdom, okay, their hands and the same material to make replicas or miniatures. So I already have done the entire collection of Goa Chitra in miniature form. That is 1:10 scale, using the same material as the original object and the same artisan to make them. The idea is, if at all I am a bit sensitive about culture and these things, it's because I grew up on toys which were made of wood. Okay, I want to develop this miniatures into sets, you know, kitchen toys, your farming tools, okay, as tools, so that the children of the future can learn about agriculture through these toys, the same way I knew about kitchen, about fruits, about vegetables. Like, for example, the gano that we spoke about, okay, I've done a miniature of that gano, you know, where a child will be able to assemble a gano and understand how it worked. The entire plow set, all the agricultural tools, kitchen tools, are all done in miniature format.
Amazing. And can people buy this? Can they buy this?
Not right now. Right? See, you know, Clyde, I basically have three problems. One is the weather condition here in Goa. I'm very close to the sea. So my major enemy is salinity and humidity. The second problem that I have is finance. All my museums are self-funded. My only source of income is, you know, I restore houses. So whatever money I earn, I put in this project. So that has become a problem. So since I've always wanted to do replicas would be very expensive for me to do, I decided to do the miniatures. And each miniature to make the prototype has cost me over 8,000 rupees. I really do not have the money right now to make copies of it. But what I'm very successful today and happy about is at least before that artisan could die, the maker of the original tool, that I've made a miniature. Tomorrow, if that miniature, if we give it to anyone, okay, we'll be able to understand what that tool looks like. Also, the idea is to set up mini museums in schools, you know, so that they understand where they come from, you know, because our educational system has really failed us. Education was meant to uplift us from where we come from, not uproot us. So what the educational system lacks is what I'm trying to give it to the future generation. That's my contribution to the future children of Goa.
I think that's amazing because honestly, like I said before also, generally, I personally, whenever I go to any of these, you know, like Prince of Wales museums or any of these kind of very, very, I don't know, formal museums, I get super, super bored. And I think just hearing what you're doing with all your museums, whether it's the food or the fishing or Goa Chitra or Goa Kruti, it's just so participative. And this whole miniature angle is a way of you digitizing it and preserving it for future as well, right?
That's true.
So do you, are you also taking photographs so that it's also preserved maybe in a digitized kind of form as well? Are you doing that as well?
Yes, not only photographs. I've done drawings, rhino drawings of each and every object of mine. A rhino drawing is a 3D drawing. Like if I get some money, I can easily do a sort of moving object, you know, where you can see the object from different angles through animation. We can probably do Goa's first digital pictorial, you know, ethnographic collection encyclopedia, you know, which no one has done before.
Yeah, on a lighter note, I think we can talk to Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook because he's creating the metaverse. And I think, I don't know if you've heard of this, but maybe we need someone, you know, like that who will kind of help digitize this for all sorts of future generations. So I hope, you know, that happens for you soon. And coming now to the present, you know, like, what do you think will be the museums of the future? Like 100 years from now, if someone has to create a museum, what do you think will be the artifacts of the future?
Yeah, even though I see a lot of digital museums coming up, I still feel that we have loads and loads of stuff. Like, just see, in our lifetime, we have seen a valve radio turning into a transistor radio. We have seen right from a LP player to a spool player to a cassette player to a CD player and so on. Okay, that itself is a collection. Every era will leave behind something. Every culture will leave behind something which would be of museum use. The idea today, what I have done is so that people can have that idea that anything, okay, would be a museum piece one day. So generation to generation, there would be something that we would be discarding. We would be growing out of it, okay, which will be a museum piece. Okay, but the only thing, I'm not for digital museums, especially in an era when these things are still there. We have not attempted going around collecting. I went around like a madman. I was totally obsessed, man, okay, to collect the last piece that existed anywhere. I would leave anything. If someone had to tell me, Victor, something is seen in so-and-so area, I would leave everything that I was doing and run to that place to find it. That was my thing. I wish, okay, someone, you know, a youngster of the future takes a similar interest.
Yeah, for me, the way I look at it, right, Victor, is like, I mean, like, you're doing this amazing job of collecting artifacts. For me personally, my museum is the museum of stories and ideas, which is what I'm kind of good at, which is words.
Of course.
So that's my museum that I want, you know, to leave behind as a legacy for young people. And you just spoke about young people now and what they can do. So any advice that you can give them for how they can maybe preserve Goan culture, what do you think they can do?
Can I tell you something very interesting, Clyde? So I was there in Europe for a long time. I visited over 40 museums. But let me tell you, the biggest gallery of theirs is the Southeast Asian Gallery, out of which almost 90% of the objects are from India. Do you know their struggle?
Wow.
They have the objects, but they do not have a story. Why they do not have the story? Because those objects belong to other countries and other cultures. What we don't understand in Goa or in India is that we have the story, we have the narrative, we are destroying it. Stories, narratives is of the future.
Amazing. No, I think young people need to immerse themselves in the stories of their land because that's what Goa has. It has a story which dates back thousands, maybe 2,000 years ago. And to kind of fall in love with it and maybe find a way to kind of preserve it on their own. Because, you know, I'm doing it through my stories and through my words. You're doing it with your museums. So, I mean, I think after listening to this, our audience is going to be very, very excited to head straight away from their train or plane or bus, wherever they get down, and make sure that beyond the beach, they head to Banauli and they go to your museum. And I'm hoping that you get all sorts of you know, audiences who come and fall in love with the Goa that is of the past, but can help in preserving the future. So hopefully people listening to this podcast will fall in love with your story and maybe they'll do something. That's what we can hope. So thanks, Victor. Now I'm moving to my next segment of the podcast. It's called our Susegad Secret segment. So obviously, because my book is called Susegad, The Goan Art of Contentment, it's a bit of a vague question maybe, but can you tell me what is it that brings, you know, Susegad to you? I kind of know what might bring Susegad to you. For me, it means just doing things that I love and trying to be in balance with my nature and with my passions, you know. So what is Susegad to you? What does it mean?
For me, Susegad is anything Goan. As I've said, I breathe, I eat, I live Goa. I dream Goa all the time, literally. Okay? So I do not, even though I'm a member of many of these five-star hotels, I've never ever eaten in a single five-star hotel. Okay? I go to local places. There's this book which I'm compiling, which is called 365 Restaurants for 365 Days in Goa. Each of these restaurants is without a signage. Okay? It is where families, traditional families, have kept traditional food alive. Okay, so it's, for me, that is my relaxation. Every time I move out, it has to be Goan. I can't have anything that's fancy. Even when I was in Lucknow, I had my container of salt fish. I had my container of pickles from Goa. Yeah? I had a container of my sausages from Goa. Okay, that's where, how I lived. Wherever I've gone, wherever I go. For me, Susegad, relaxing is with anything Goan. Listening to Konkani music, listening to stories. You know, there is one culture that is we are missing today. Stories being told to children. Today, we know stories like Harry Potter and stuff like that has come up for children, you know. Okay, otherwise, we grew up with stories about Goa. For me, that is a relaxation.
So the other question that I want to ask you, and it's a very personal one to me, because I think that, you know, it's love that makes people do all sorts of things. And it's love for Goa that has made you do and has given a mission to you for your life. So what is the meaning of love to you?
First and foremost, to be in love, you need to love yourself.
Wow.
So basically, it all starts from here. You know, I love myself. I love my ideas. I love my dreams. And that is what I share with anyone I come across. It's that passion. It's that zest for life.
Wow. So self-love, I think, is what you are kind of saying is what is the meaning of love to you. Love yourself first and then everything else.
Exactly. Otherwise, you won't be able to share, no?
Very well put, Victor. Great. So now I'm coming to the other segment of my podcast. It's called the rapid fire segment. So question number one of our rapid fire round is, what is your favorite antique?
I have two. Both are Ghanaians. One is the oil grinder. And the second one is a sugarcane crusher, which was of 1886. Both these took me maximum time to restore. Okay, and these are the pride of Goa Chitra.
Wow, okay. I'm waiting to see them, honestly. Okay, my second question to you is, an ancient implement that you have or you came across that completely blew your mind because of the wisdom that it had ingrained in it?
The yoke.
Amazing, which you've spoken about. So we all know that. If any of our listeners have skipped and come back to this question, please go back and listen to that amazing story of the yoke and you'll realize how sustainable our Goan ancestors were.
I also have a flute, okay, which was used by the Dangar community. Okay, it's an upright flute, very rare flute with a reed in the center, which was used to collect their animals in the evening. Okay, because the Dangars, they leave their goats in the jungle. Okay, so in the evening at sunset, they would stand with that flute and play that flute and all those animals would come in the direction of the sound.
Absolutely amazing, really. It's like futuristic technology almost. Okay, third question is, a sustainable Goan practice that you yourself follow?
As I've said, I live on a farm. I grow my own food. Okay, we do not cut trees. We do not kill animals. Possibly, I am the only one in Goa. I don't know anyone else who does not have government supply of water. I drink water from my well.
Wow, amazing. Okay, so my fourth question to you is, what's your absolute favorite yummy Goan food?
One thing which is a must for me with any food, any of my meal, be it lunch or dinner, is a Goan pickle or something with salt fish.
All right, my fifth question on our rapid fire round is, what's your favorite museum in the whole world?
The Apartheid Museum in South Africa, it's mind-blowing. It's partly digital, but the entire story, the feeling of what happened during the apartheid, you can see as you enter.
Okay, so that's the end of our rapid fire. I want to ask you this question, Victor, because your Konkani is excellent and you have some really good Konkani phrases. So as we want to do with this podcast is we want people to learn and love and kind of start living the Goan lifestyle. So can you please share one Konkani phrase which you love, one Konkani phrase and what it means, and maybe just quickly just give an example of how it is used in
okay.
a sentence.
One very important thing, you know, is we keep on looking for consultants, okay, to do things in Goa. There's an old saying in Konkani, "Andir asa chero, sotta soglo vado," which means the child is with you, are holding the child, but you're looking all over for your child.
Correct. And I think to paraphrase what you said, which is so beautiful, is basically the search is not outside, the search is within. So, Victor, I thank you for joining us on the Susegaad Stories podcast. And it has honestly been very enjoyable. And I'm sure our audience would also feel the same way. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you so much, Clyde, for inviting me for this broadcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of Susegaad Stories from Goa. Do subscribe if you're a new listener and join a community of people who love and live the Goan lifestyle. Again, I'm Clyde D'Souza, and for more Goan content, you can follow me on Instagram at Clyde D'Souza Author. This podcast is brought to you by Bound, a company that helps you grow through stories. Follow them at Bound India on all social platforms for updates on this podcast or take a look at their other podcasts. Moga Suni and see you soon.